Hello and welcome to Heroes and Humans of Football. My name is Mehreen Khan.
And I'm Simon Cooper. This is the football show where we take the hero and we show you the human.
From Johan Cruyff to Megan Rapinoe.
And from George Best to Kylian Mbappe.
This is the Human Football Podcast. Last week's episode was on Mohamed Salah, the man they called the Egyptian king. Be sure to give it a listen.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. We're here to talk about the rise and fall of Arsene Wenger. Why was he great and why did he stop being great? He arrives at Arsenal in 1996 and he's probably the most transformative person in the history of the Premier League. He does more than anyone to change English football and he creates possibly the best football team at that point to have ever played in the English League. And I watched them in the late 90s avidly. And his Invincibles go through the whole 2003-04 season unbeaten, first time in the history of English football. They're wonderful, and then they're not. His last decade or so at Arsenal is a terrible anticlimax. So what is it about Wenger that he was great and then he stopped being great? In this first episode of our doubleheader on Arsene Wenger, we're going to look at the rise, the glory years.
I'm very much looking forward to this one. Arsene Wenger is one of those titans of my young footballing life. And you never really shake it because, you know, I started watching football when it was a duopoly between Wenger's Arsenal and United's Fergie. And I think a disclaimer for some of our younger listeners is that Arsene Wenger is not just like a internet meme, right? Which is what he became in his latter years, or the guy that spawned this toxic culture around Arsenal and Arsenal Fan TV, AFTV, which is now one of the biggest fan channels in the world. It's always born out of the frustration of
Arsenal
fans.
Toxic culture?
Yeah. I mean, I will argue in the second part of this episode that one of the legacies that Arsene left at Arsenal, especially towards the sort of dog days of his reign, Arsenal fans became some of the most toxic football fans in English football. And that was never something you would associate with Arsenal in the 90s or the early 2000s when Wenger was in his heyday. So for some of the younger listeners, it's actually going to be worth reiterating how much of a pioneer he actually was and not just the guy on the touchline that failed to zip up his coat three times, which is one of the enduring images that I actually have of Arsene Wenger.
We should add the disclaimer that you are a Chelsea fan and so that you come at this with a horrendous bias.
No, but I also completely love him.
Oh, that's
so
good.
Because he becomes such a, I would say, pathetic figure by the end. I have a huge amount of sympathy and a bit of sadness when I think about Arsene Wenger.
Talk us through the stats on Wenger, Mehreen.
1996 is when he arrives. Wenger wins three titles for Arsenal, three FA Cups in those first 8 years up until 2004. 2003-2004 is the landmark season. Arsenal go through a season without being beaten. I would add two little caveats. They are beaten by Chelsea in the quarterfinals of the Champions League and they get knocked out of the FA Cup by Manchester United. But they go through an entire domestic season being unbeaten. Pep's Man City have never done that. Mourinho's Chelsea came close in one season. They've never even...
Nobody's ever done it.
Nobody's ever done it. And very few of even those dominant teams that gather 100 points a season, which seems to be becoming more normal now in English football, haven't even got close. And then it peters out quite spectacularly and he wins next to nothing apart from a handful of FA Cups.
In the last 14 years at Arsenal, Wenger wins just three FA Cups. But perhaps the most astounding stat about Wenger is that he spends 22 years as Arsenal manager. Now, the average tenure in the Premier League today for managers is a bit under 2 years. So he alone, he's kind of the whole league. He's the only person who's been there forever.
Before we get into all the biographical details about Wenger, let's talk about the look, because he's a whole vibe.
Well, the look transforms.
It doesn't. It kind of doesn't. The continuity's there. I mean, he's a lithe guy. He's skinny. He has too many bones in his face. He's got those big glasses, those ill-fitting suits. He doesn't look like a football man.
When he arrives at Arsenal, he looks like a lab technician.
The guy swirling around the funny chemicals in the...
Yeah, lives with his mother and wears these protective glasses all the time.
Yeah.
Even for social events. And there are these very bizarre pictures of new Wenger at Arsenal. Beige suit. Too big for him,
yeah.
Which is weird because he's very
big. Mr. Bean, red tie, brown suit.
Yeah. Arsenal give him this training top with his initials, AW, on it. And it's too big. And so he's very unstylish. And that's also why initially he's rejected by English football. Like, who is this guy, this French lab technician taking over a historic English club? And then suddenly he arrives in England. The Premier League's on TV all the time. And suddenly he's a public face. People know what he looks like. And they say, you look like a lab technician. He lives with his mum and he doesn't really care, but he's being mocked for it. And he realizes that it diminishes his standing, that he's not taken as seriously as he should be by players and by media because of the way he looks. And I suspect that that's when he gets a makeover.
The contact lenses.
Yeah. So they hire a stylist. Somebody hires a stylist. And the stylist finds these fantastic suits and these very soft ties that actually fit him.
Fitted, yeah.
Yeah. And contact lenses, as you say. And he ends up, he looks great.
He does look good.
Yeah.
And everything about Arsenal looked good. I mean, Thierry Henry is doing mainstream adverts for cars. Freddie Ljungberg was doing underwear adverts.
That's right,
I mean, they were a whole vibe, that whole thing. And I think Wenger kind of learned that there's a lot of power in the visuals.
Yeah.
And I think he embraced it to some degree and he probably enjoyed it by the end.
It's only when he gets to Arsenal that he has to develop a look. And he does so very successfully.
He cuts a very unique figure in the general milieu of English managers. Now, of course, like they all wear amazing suits and, you know, they're Armani models. And Mourinho was also part of that. I think he understood the power of the visuals really early on.
Yeah, and Guardiola, his wife, owns a clothing boutique.
And used to dress him. And now, like, you know, there are whole internet pages about the kind of shoes and watches the football managers wear. And I think maybe Wenger was the beginning of us actually really caring about how these guys look properly.
You'd put him up there as an icon with the people you've just mentioned?
Yeah. I mean, the 90s is back as a whole fashion vibe. And you look back at those throwback pictures of Wenger and he's a style icon, man.
Why is he a style icon?
He just encapsulates that age. The glasses, I'm so glad that he's taken the contact lenses out. So if you notice now, he's put the glasses back on. Mm-hmm. And we see him when he's
I've done the same with age.
Yeah. I mean, just gives him a bit of gravitas, you know, the whole shoulder pads, vibes. There was that unfortunate moment he had with the world's longest puffer jacket when he failed to do a zip up at Old Trafford, which is one of the funniest things.
You said he tried three times to
I've
zip it?
I've ever seen. He just can't zip it up. So he does fall foul of these kind of little Clouseau moments, as like Ian Wright would say. But I think he's going to go down as an absolute fashion icon.
Wow. Well, high praise from you.
Yeah. We love the Wenger look. All right, we'll come back to the looks.
Important subject.
But let's return now to his early life in France. Simon, tell us about that.
Wenger comes from a small village called Duttlenheim in the Alsace. And the Alsace is, of course, a phenomenon among buffs of European history because it's where the Franco-German wars always start. So it's this region which is now in France, but where until 1940, people would just speak dialects of German in daily life. And so in Wenger's village, a dialect of German was the local language. And
because
so
it passes hands between France and Germany.
Yeah, the Germans always trying to conquer the Alsace in 1870, in 1914.
I don't know why the food is actually so bad.
Well, it's sort of German food.
So bad.
So in 1940, Hitler conquers the Alsace, this essentially German-speaking region of France. And he says, right, this is now Germany. It's always really been Germany. And therefore, all the men here are going to fight in the German army in my wars. And so all the men in the village of Duttlenheim, including Wenger's dad, get conscripted into the German army. And they go away and they fight World War II for Hitler. You know, I read Wenger's autobiography and he deals with this topic in less than a paragraph. But then I interviewed him about the book. You know, I said, it must have been extraordinarily weird. You're born in 1949 in this village where people still speak a dialect of German. You're growing up speaking German essentially as your first language. And all the men around you, including your dad, had fought for Hitler. What was that like? And Wenger said, well, yes, my dad did fight for the Germans on the Russian front. And my mother told me when the father came back, he was 42 kilograms, emaciated. The end of 1945, it looked like the father was going to die. He spent months in hospital. And then he recovers and he runs this bistro where Wenger grows up, essentially in the village bistro run by his parents. And all these men who fought for Hitler, and they never talk about it. It's never discussed. And it kind of hangs over the village like a cloud. Because, of course, in France after the war, you can't sort of readily talk about how you're all in the Wehrmacht together. I said, you know, to Wenger, how did this affect you, the legacy of World War II? You know, you're growing up in this family, the youngest of three children. And he said, in my family, we didn't speak a lot about the war. It was like a banned subject. The forbidden knowledge that all the men in the village had fought for the Nazis, including his own dad. So you have the Alsace, you have the unspoken memory of World War II, and then you have this, which is very important for Wenger's development, living with two languages. So at home, they speak this German dialect. And when he goes to school, at school, he learns French. And he has trouble at school initially because he doesn't really speak French when he starts. And it's only when he's 15, he suddenly gets his head together. He catches up on the whole curriculum by himself. And then he goes off to university and does an economics degree.
But football also features in this young life. So I've heard him describe the bistro, which becomes almost like a clubhouse for the local team. Because before games kick off and the village club, the players leave from the restaurant and go get changed and go and play football. And that's one of his first early exposures to football in a small town.
So his parents' bistro is a very raucous, very male. There are no women there. And he's watching the local men, farmers, they lie to each other, people get drunk, and then over the evening, brawls start breaking out. People would tell stories, they would tell jokes, they would laugh, they would charm each other. And I think he learns there his skills as a raconteur, his skill as somebody who can sit there and tell a spellbinding story that everybody will listen to, which in a kind of culture of the bistro like that is really, really important. And so he sees this very male world. And as a small kid, he starts to learn how to deal with men of all kinds. And he develops these bistro social skills that will carry him through his career as a manager. But he said the obsession of all these men was football. And so the village team, which he eventually plays for, there's no coach and they don't have training sessions. So he goes through his whole youth untrained, which knowing Wenger now seems very bizarre. But he says that he learned from the bistro, he absorbed the idea the most important thing in life is football.
So Wenger's grown up in this relatively isolated place, but one which has quite a tumultuous history between France and Germany.
And very recent history when
he was
born.
Very recent.
And also, importantly, his father is a workaholic, essentially doing two full-time jobs. His mother is working in the bistro all day. So what he sees from his parents is life is work. There isn't anything else. And I think he absorbs that and it becomes the life that he himself will lead. He becomes a full-blown workaholic. In a sense, he has a real problem.
So he understands football is something that people care about a lot. And given that there's probably other voids in his life, it takes an outsized importance in his life. But how does he get himself out of Dettelheim? And is it clear that he always wants to leave?
Well, he goes to the University of Strasbourg and he gets an economics degree. And he has a mathematician's brain. He can solve maths puzzles. And this is going to be very important in his time at Arsenal manager because he sees himself as a kind of economist running a football club. And he has very particular ideas about money, which I think in the end will be part of his downfall at Arsenal. So he's got this degree and he's a decent footballer. He's never been coached, doesn't have much technique. He's good enough, though, to get into semi-professional clubs in the Alsace region. And he ends up at the great club of Alsace, Racing Club de Strasbourg, which everyone in his village of Dettelheim supported. So he's in Strasbourg. He doesn't really become a first team regular, but he spends years there and he ends up running the academy as well. While he's still a player, he's running the youth academy. So it's his first taste of coaching.
In some senses, Strasbourg is a kind of perfect place to help birth someone like Wenger, who you say is a consummate European and has this amazing ability to talk and network with Europeans about football.
Yeah, so he is fascinated by Germany. He doesn't feel any hatred from the war. And as an Alsatian, he also feels, I suppose, partly German. The culture to some degree is the same. And Germany in the 70s, when he's starting to get interested in coaching, is the best country in the world. They win the World Cup 74. So he's always getting into his car and driving to Germany and watching his, especially his beloved Borussia Mönchengladbach, and then driving back and arriving home at 5 a.m. And so he's just totally imbibing German football. He loves it. He later takes a French coaching course. He admires the Dutch as well. So he's taking in these influences from all over Europe.
And he has the benefit of proximity. He can just hop in a car and cross borders and do this kind of stuff. Because you can do this kind of stuff in what, 70s?
Yeah, yeah. You just get into your petrol belching car and you drive many hours across long, dangerous roads and there you are in Mönchengladbach. Yeah. No, it's fantastic for him. But he also, I think, crucially, he has the languages. And it reminds me a lot of Pep Guardiola because Guardiola also comes from a kind of region of two languages. In Guardiola's case, it's Catalan and Spanish. And if you grow up speaking two languages, like Guardiola did and Wenger did, it's easy to add more languages. And so that's what they both end up doing. And the thing about Wenger is he's really a people person. And the couple of times I've spent time with him, this really surprised me. Because as a journalist, you see him, or you saw him at the press conference, and he'd have this kind of glare.
Dour
scowl, complaining about the referees, quite a frightening figure. And then when you saw him in intimate surroundings, he was this charming raconteur. He was very funny, he told great stories, he knew everyone. In private, he's a very likable, warm guy. I remember once in Paris, 5-star hotel, so of course the kind of place where football people hang out. And I'm there with Wenger and a couple of people. Fabien Barthez walks by.
Legend. Did you kiss his head?
Wenger didn't kiss his head, but Wenger turns, he goes, Fabien. And it's like, and Barthez never played for Wenger. He played for the rival for Manchester United. But it's like old friends. They know each other deeply and they have this very intimate, cheery conversation. And you realise the guy knows everyone and they all like him. And seeing him so charming, so at ease, such a good storyteller, I thought this is what you can get growing up as a small child in a bistro.
We're getting a sense of his character. He is almost single-mindedly focused on football, all facets of football. There is a slight difference with Pep when we spoke about Pep.
Our episode on Pep, which everybody should listen to, obviously.
It's fantastic. But one of the things that you stressed a lot was that Pep is taking a lot from outside cultures, right? He's got this best mate who plays handball. He's trying to imbibe music, culture, history. Whereas with Wenger, it just seems like it's just kind of football.
Yeah, I mean, Wenger really is a monomaniac. He's a very intelligent man who more and more over his life decides that to be very good at something, you have to devote your whole life to it. There is no space for anything else.
And it's goal-oriented, right? So you learn the languages, he learns English because he knows at some point he wants to come and manage in England.
That was very striking, reading his autobiography. He has had never any contact with England, but he realises at some point in my life, English is going to be important. So he just flies to England, takes a train to Cambridge, because he's heard, somebody's told him, you have to go to Cambridge to learn English. Best
obviously.
Place, obviously. He arrives in Cambridge, he's got no contacts, and he knows he's looking for a language school. So he knocks on various doors, and eventually he gets directed to this landlady, who's also a language teacher. And he doesn't speak any English.
He's Madame, 29. Excusez-moi.
Madame, I would like her. And they test him, and they say, well, you're going to be in the intermediate class. And he gets into the intermediate class, and it's him, 29-year-old Wenger, footballer at Strasbourg, with all these teenagers, these 14-year-olds. So he's in this class of these 14-year-olds, but he is totally fixated on, he's just going to learn it. He's just going to learn English. And also because his teacher is his landlady, he really wants to impress her. He wants to show that he's a good pupil. And so he does 3 weeks in Cambridge. And then he feels, obviously, I've just started, so I have to really keep up my English now. So for the next few years, he reads all sorts of English novels and other things. He underlines every word he doesn't know. So he's just keeping his English up to speed, knowing that one day, maybe, it will be useful.
Okay, so he's in his early 30s. Playing doesn't quite work out, but Wenger's not going to let football disappear from his life, far from it. And he jumps headfirst into coaching and puts so much of this kind of obsessive attention to detail and single-mindedness into managing small French clubs.
So he starts at Nancy and immediately he's an obsessive. Just before Christmas, they lose a match under his managership and he's devastated. It's like, you know, he's lost his entire immediate family. But he does pretty well. He gets to Monaco and over 7 years there, he makes his name at Monaco.
That's a proper club.
Yeah, it's a proper club. And he thinks they're the best club in France. The rivals are Marseille. And he says, well, Marseille are, you know, bribing and match fixing. And so we couldn't win anything. So he's very bitter about that.
He was kind of proven right by that.
He was correct about that, I think, in part anyway. One of the things always to keep in mind about him is he's a mathematician at heart. He's an economist. And so he looks at football and he thinks we need to apply data here. Just at that time, there's this sort of probably the first computer program using data on football in the history of the world in the 80s called TopScore. And he pioneers the use of TopScore, which is developed by a friend of his. And it gives points for everything a player does on the field, like a forward pass, you get 1 point, you know, score a goal, you get 5 points, that kind of thing. And so he tots up the points that each player's got. And he starts to notice the players with the most points are the ones who go on to have really good careers. There's some meaning in this data. And he's also starting to monitor half the leagues around the world. I mean, nobody else is watching football outside their own country.
How does
certainly
he watch
not
football?
In France. He's watching German football obsessively, but he also has all these people he phones up.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this person in Cameroon who he calls all the time, trying to get information on important players in the Cameroonian league. He's probably doing that with, you know, the Mauritian league and the Bolivian league as well. He's heard about this Liberian kid playing in the Cameroonian league called George Weah. Nobody's heard of George Weah. Wenger's getting reports every week on Weah from Cameroon. And the report said, yeah, this kid, he's a good footballer, a bit of a rough diamond though. And Wenger's intrigued. And eventually he sends a Monaco colleague to Africa to watch Weah. After the match, the colleague phones Wenger and he says, well, the bad news is Weah broke an arm during the match. The good news, he kept playing after that. And Wenger thought, wow, there's something in this kid. So he signs George Weah.
Amazing.
Brings him to France and Weah signs. And then he sits at the table with his head in his hands, looking despairing. Wenger said, George, you know, cheer up. You just signed for Monaco. Not bad, right? Weah says, yeah, boss, but I don't have any money. Nobody's ever given me any money. So Wenger pulls 500 French francs out of his pocket, which, you know, is about £60. And he gives it to Weah. Wenger jokes that that's Weah's signing on bonus. Mm. And in 1995, George Weah is named World Footballer of the Year.
Amazing.
And he gives the award to Wenger because he feels Wenger is the man who made and discovered him. And a lot of the great players later on will feel that kind of bond with Wenger. These players, they respect Wenger partly because he respects them, which is unusual in football, where often, you know, it's a very hierarchical world where the manager just treats players like dirt.
Okay, so Wenger's doing a decent job in Monaco. He's not really pulling up any trees. He's at a relatively minor French club, wasn't an amazing player. How does he get onto the radar of Arsenal in the 80s, which is a club not particularly known for its network in European football?
Yeah, no English club at this point has a foreign network at all. It's like the rest of the world doesn't exist. It's as if the whole football world is England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland and Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is much more significant in English football at this point than, say, France or Germany. And so there is absolutely no way that an unknown Frenchman like Wenger would become the manager of any English club, let alone a big club like Arsenal. It's just not going to happen. So how does it happen?
So we'll find out how Arsenal discover Arsène after the break. This is a reminder that you're listening to Heroes and Humans of Football with me, Mehreen Khan.
And me, Simon Cooper.
Welcome back. You're joining us as we're about to discuss how Arsene Wenger becomes the manager of Arsenal Football Club. And it all begins with a very fortuitous meeting at the beginning of January 1989, Simon. What happens?
So what does Wenger do when he's not running his club? He's scouting. He's watching football. That's what he does in his spare time. And so he spends the New Year's break, 1988-89, in Turkey, you know, probably watching a dozen football matches. And then when it's New Year's Day, he thinks, what shall I do? I know, I'll go to London and watch more football. So through Dennis Roach, I think, who's Glenn Hoddle's agent, because Hoddle is playing
for Monaco
under Wenger, Wenger gets a ticket to Arsenal. And so you'd arrive at this little Highbury Stadium, and there'd be these streets of these quite quiet, almost suburban houses. Wenger arrives there in a taxi, January 89, and he gets out and he says to the taxi driver, well, where's the stadium then? And the driver says, oh, it's right there. You just can't see it because it's a small thing hidden by houses. And Wenger thinks, wow, that's kind of weird and fascinating. It's a really old-fashioned English club in the middle of a neighbourhood where people actually live, not what he's used to at all. He's a guest of the club because he's got this ticket. And the directors, at halftime, they go to the directors' room, which I think at Highbury was oak-panelled, and only the directors allowed in, and they would have their brandies or whatever they did. And the wives were not allowed in, and the guests couldn't get into the directors' room. So Wenger's with the other guests and the wives, and he gets talking to this woman who's a friend of the wife of David Dean. Dean is a crucial figure in the Wenger saga. Dean is this London businessman. He's been a sugar trader, I think a coffee trader, and he's made some cash. And in 1983, he has this crazy idea. He's going to buy a sixth of Arsenal for £292,000, for which you wouldn't even get sort of half a toilet in central London nowadays. I know this guy who was offered by Dean to come in on the deal. Dean said, come on, we'll buy a bit of Arsenal together. And the guy said, no, obviously I'm not going to put any money into football. That's crazy. Live to regret it. So Dean is this very dynamic figure. He's the Arsenal vice chairman. And that day, he and Wenger get talking. And Wenger, this is where the language is paid off, because he gets invited that evening after the game to David Dean's house. And so what did they do? What did people in the 80s do? They played charades. Do you know what charades are?
Is that one of those games where you have to mime stuff out and then the other person has to guess what it is, a book or a film?
Yeah. So at one point, Wenger has to mime A Midsummer Night's Dream.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Can you imagine limbs everywhere?
Yeah. And anyway, it pays off because he and Dean, they become friends. And happily, Dean, of course, he has a yacht, which is moored in a south of France harbour near Monaco.
Monaco, of course.
And so he starts going to Monaco matches and they become soulmates. Wenger is ready to leave Monaco. He's been there 7 years. He's sick of what he sees as the match fixing by the rivals Marseille. He thinks I'm in a rigged game. And he gets this offer from Japan. So he says, right, I'm a world traveller. I'm off. Goodbye, France.
Why does he end up in Japan and not just a middling or even low kind of job in another European league?
Nobody knows who he is. Nobody knows Arsene Wenger in the early 90s. He didn't have a proper playing career. There isn't much kind of exchange between countries at this point. I mean, he's not a kind of flamboyant hero like, you know, Franz Beckenbauer or Rudi Füller, who are the people who do get offers from other countries. Wenger is a nobody. He's only ever worked in France. He has no profile at all. It's amazing that any foreign club is interested in him. I don't know how Grand Passeig, this club in Japan, discovered that there's something special about this guy. But anyway, they do, and they hire him. So he lands in Japan. I think Japanese has three, what we would call alphabets, and he can't read a single character in any of them. Every day he drives 40 minutes to the stadium and he navigates by the advertising billboards. So he recognizes the ads, and his hope every day is that the ads haven't changed, so his navigation will still work. And the team he inherits are bottom of the league and had recently lost 17 matches in a row. So it's not very propitious, right? Who'd ever heard of Japanese football? His team is the worst in the league, and very quickly he loses 8 matches in a row. And so directors call him in. And he's sure, obviously, they're going to sack me. I've lost 8 matches in a row. And instead they say to him, well, we are firing your interpreter.
He's literally lost the translation. What a fool guy, man.
Well, the directors say, look, if you can't communicate your brilliant ideas to your players, it must be the false interpreter.
Fault.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they shoot the messenger. He loves Japan. He kind of realizes, I think, he has a Japanese soul.
Because he
thinks this is a very perfectionist culture. So in a sense, in Japan, he perfects his perfectionism. He watches Japanese women arrange flowers. He sees cleaners pick up these tiny bits of paper. And he thinks, wow, this attention to detail. And so he's learning, that's what he's done since he was a teenager. He's been absorbing ideas from other countries. And he thinks, right, I'm a natural workaholic, and so I have to become a kind of Japanese-style workaholic. And his players are workaholics too. He has to hide footballs, otherwise they'll train before training. They arrive early, and they will start playing this very intensive football and training. And then the training session starts, and they're already knackered. So he has to hide the footballs from them. And he even the crowds are totally into it. He says, the crowds, there's this total fervor and then silence. And then sometimes when we lose, you'd see a single tear rolling down a supporter's cheek. So he's very moved by Japan. He loves it. He doesn't want to lose a second of his life anymore in relaxing. So he's becoming a workaholic, or he's becoming the kind of full-blown version of a workaholic in Japan.
Does the Wenger method actually work with Grampus in the end?
Yeah, it really does. He does turn the club around. So they win 17 of 27 games. They finish second in the league in 95. He's the manager of the year in Japan. And they win the Emperor's Cup.
He's big in Japan, man.
Big in Japan, yeah. He's very much admired in Japan. And so when Arsenal come knocking against David Dean, they come back to him, they've appointed Bruce Brioche, it's really not working out. And so David Dean remembers, my soulmate in Japan, Arsene Wenger, we have to get him. So this Arsenal delegation, they fly to Japan and they say, you're nobody, you look like a lab technician, everyone in England is going to laugh if we appoint you, but we would love you to be our manager. And this is like a dream offer. It's never going to happen again, a big club in Europe coming to him. And he says, well, I cannot leave now because I have given my commitment to Grampus 8. And so I'm not free at this moment. And Arsenal say, well, look, you're the right man for us, so we'll just wait as long as it takes. And so they appoint Pat Rice, who's kind of Arsenal veteran, stalwart, ex-player, as the caretaker. And Wenger monitors this from Japan for a few months.
So Wenger eventually does end up at Arsenal, but in those couple of seasons in Japan, he's probably become the most Wengerist of Wenger, right? So he's learned to be more meticulous, more attention to detail. He's living in a society which he sees as incredibly disciplined. These are all the traits that he's going to take with him when he becomes only the fourth ever foreign manager to be appointed in the English top flight league.
Yeah, this is just totally weird. A Frenchman with no reputation, and everyone greets him with skepticism. Nobody can believe it. There's this famous tabloid headline when Arsenal appoints him, Arsene who?
Well, it's the infamous post-game interview with Ian Wright. So they tell him, Arsenal will be looking for a new manager. It's going to be Arsene Wenger. And he goes, Arsene who? And that was it. It sticks. And even your man, Johan Cruyff, was potentially in the running for that job, was he not?
Yeah, occasionally clubs would try and appoint Cruyff, but he didn't like to go outside Barcelona.
Okay.
Yeah.
Indulge that fancy. But imagine going from somebody that everyone in football's heard of to some bespectacled dude from Japan.
Yeah, and Tony Adams, who's the Arsenal captain, who's about to come out as an alcoholic, he's very sceptical. He says, he thinks at this point, what does this Frenchman know about football? He wears glasses and looks more like a schoolteacher. Does he even speak English properly?
What's pre-Wenger Arsenal like? The thing that I always hear is boring Arsenal, 1-0 to the Arsenal, George Graham's Arsenal, this kind of practical, they win, but there's nothing particularly special about them. And Simon, you actually used to go and watch Arsenal back in the day.
George Graham's Arsenal were a very ugly team to watch. I mean, they already had this famous Arsenal back four in my memory of Adams and Keown and Dixon and Winterburn. And then they had these forwards who couldn't really play football. They won the league and I couldn't believe it. How can a team like this win the league? But it was very ugly. And then by the mid-90s, they're struggling. So they've appointed Bruce Rioch as manager and they've bought this epoch-transcending genius, Dennis Bergkamp.
So in the midst of all of this fresh mediocrity, there's this guy called Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah, there's this genius. And Bergkamp is thinking, what have I landed in? And I remember his first match in the league, he realizes nobody's going to pass to me. The ball just flies over my head all the time. So he starts going back to the back of central midfield, defensive midfield position, just to pick up the ball.
Sweeping.
Because he just wants to touch the ball and nobody will give it to him. Also, Bergkamp's very perturbed by the eating and drinking habits. So the pre-match meal was baked beans with Coca-Cola.
Even for a Dutchman, that's got to be pretty bad.
And some players, he would remember, went onto the pitch burping. You had two people who were soon going to come out as alcoholics in the team, Adams and Paul Merson, who was a wonderful footballer. Mm. So you'd have players coming to training in the morning with alcohol in their breath. And so this is the club that Wenger inherited. Nobody really wants him there. And it's a club in a bit of a mess. But he has this huge advantage. He actually knows football in the rest of the world, which nobody else in England does. He said later, it felt like I was opening the door to the rest of the world. He's bringing foreign methods into this Neanderthal English game and he transforms it, I think, more profoundly than any other figure who enters English football in any era.
And I've heard Martin Keown and others who are around who are very sceptical about the fact that their diets have to change, their sleeping habits have to change, everything they do is now monitored. But then as soon as the results come on the pitch, they're completely bought into it. And that's almost why he describes it as pushing an open door, right? It's just very easy to convince the players that this stuff is good for them and it's going to work.
Yeah, well, imagine if you go from your pre-match meal as baked beans on toast to having this totally Japanese diet that he imposes of steamed vegetables and steamed fish. And he empties the mini bars in their hotel rooms. They don't like it. So they have this chance on the players' bus, we want our Mars bars, because he's taken away the Mars bars. There's this great story from Michael Cox's book, The Mixer, where they played at Newcastle. This is before Wenger, not long before Wenger. And they have this competition on the bus back as to who can eat the most dinners. And Steve Bold, who's a kind of reserve centre-back, wins with 9 dinners.
Oh, my God.
If you can imagine doing that to your body and then you enter this Wengerian Japanese perfectionist culture. Yeah, obviously you're going to feel better. So all these defenders, they're in their late 20s, they're coming to the end of the road when Wenger takes over and they'll end up playing to their mid to late 30s because, you know, their bodies just magically transform.
So what was it like having seen pre-Wenger Arsenal and post-Wenger Arsenal?
It was very bizarre. So I'd go with these Financial Times press tickets and you'd go to this tiny little beaten up stadium, sit in the press box and you'd watch the best football that you could ever have imagined. In the late 90s, you now had Vieira, Henri, Dennis Bergkamp.
Young Anelka.
The young Anelka comes in at the first team at 17 and he scores loads of goals. And then it turns out that this English back four, who'd always seemed quite thuggish, they can all actually really play football. And Tony Adams starts giving these Beckenbauer-esque passes. And it's just this wonderful, flowing, total football team. It's bizarre. How could this happen? It felt a bit unearthly. So he creates maybe the best team, I say this without hubris, that has possibly ever played in England up to that point.
How does he do it?
Well, he brings in all these things that nobody in England is doing or knows about. So for a start, you don't drink loads of beer. You eat proper food. He starts using data to scout players. We'll come to that. But he has this really basic and simple advantage, which is that he's every night watching football from around the world and no other English manager is. Like when there was a World Cup, the managers of Premier League clubs, the start of the, in 94, they'd just go on holiday.
English football managers, managers in Premier League would go on holiday and miss the biggest tournament in the world, the World Cup, and just what, hide away from it? Not watch it? Not care?
It didn't happen. It wasn't happening in Britain, so it didn't exist.
My feeling is that because England are involved often, that this is the only thing that's happening in this country, is people watching the World Cup.
They would care especially about England, but there was no sense that any of these foreign players or managers had really any relevance to our game. We couldn't learn from them because they played in these different football cultures and they were supposedly always diving and they were prima donnas, all these xenophobic words that were used about foreign players. It was very hard to sign them. English football wasn't particularly moneyed anyway. And so it was like you were playing aliens from a different planet. Mm. And it was kind of funny to see the aliens, and they looked weird and they behaved weirdly. But obviously you weren't going to sign an alien to play for Burnley or Newcastle.
And so it takes Wenger, of course it does, a foreigner himself, to expand the talent pool of English football to countries like France, Italy.
Distant exotic countries like France.
These faraway alien planets.
They were almost impossible to reach.
And find the best footballers that were flying under the radar and create one of the greatest teams of all time with them.
So he knows who are the best players in the world. And luckily for him, the best young players in the world at that point come from his own country, mm-hmm. France. So while he's living in Japan, he somehow is also a regular on the stands at AC Milan. I guess he just, you know, flew in and then he'd fly back the next morning to Japan. And at Milan, he meets this young French reserve, Patrick Vieira, and he realizes Vieira is special. He's brilliant. He's the most incredible midfielder. Now, you didn't have to be a genius to spot that, because when he signs Vieira for Arsenal, I think Vieira plays a half against Sheffield Wednesday on his debut. And in 45 minutes, 38,000 people in the stands see, wow, he's special. So it was sort of obvious, but nobody else in England knew who Vieira was, only Wenger did. So he buys Vieira. And there's this young French winger at Juventus, a kid called Thierry Henry. Wenger says to him, you're really a goal-scoring centre-forward. And Henry says, no, boss, I don't score goals. I'm this pretty little winger who does runs down the wing. And Wenger says, no, you're a goal scorer. And he brings him to Arsenal. And of course, Henry becomes, you know, the record goal scorer in Arsenal history. And that's what Wenger can do. Because, you know, one of our questions in these podcasts is, what would the person be if there hadn't been a footballer or a manager? And with Wenger, he would have been a school teacher, because he's great at discovering gifts that people have, but they don't even know they have it themselves. And he sees what they truly are, and he makes them that. So he turns Henry into a striker. He has this player, this, is it a left back at Monaco, Emmanuel Petit?
Yeah.
And he says to Petit, you're ready, you're a midfielder. And in a few years, Petit's at Arsenal and he wins the World Cup with France as a midfielder. So he transforms players. You know, he reads autobiographies obsessively, and he realizes, reading these autobiographies, what happens in a life is the person meets someone who says, this is who you truly are. And then you become that person. And that's what he wants to be for players.
So you think he'd be a school teacher and not like a hedge fund manager poring over models of companies, deciding where to put his money to get the most value out of them? Because that's partly also how his scouting approach works. You buy them young when they're very cheap and unknown, and you see something in them and they become great. So I think Anelka was, when I remember just watching this 17-year-old playing football, and in his first season, he is trouncing teams and scoring the most incredible kind of goals. With Henri, the brilliance manifests over time. He becomes probably, I think, the greatest player the Premier League's ever seen, Arsenal's best player. Fabregas is another one. He pinches him from Barcelona's academy, ends up being a captain, doesn't win, but, you know, Fabregas is made by Wenger. So I don't know. I kind of think that he's got an investor's mind almost.
I think he has an economist's mind. So he thinks about, what is the true value of this player? Mm. So I'll buy him, if I can buy him for less than his true value, or sell him for more than his true value. But I don't see him as emotionally an investor, because an investor buys and sells. And Wenger, when he is at Arsenal, he behaves as if he's going to run the club for 100 years. Mm. He doesn't want to get in and out. He never thinks of moving up. So other clubs come in, Real Madrid come in, the club he'd loved as a fan growing up. And he says, no, he devotes himself to the place he's at. So that's why I see him as a school teacher, maybe of maths or economics, who wants to devote it to his school and to raising and improving the kids around him. But yeah, you're right that he cares about buying cheap. So other managers, they go to the chairman and say, oh, I need 10 million quid to buy this player. If they get 10 million quid, great, they're really happy. And Wenger thinks, no, what is the player worth? I need to buy him for less, sell him for more. And so he signs Henri Vieira and Robert Pires in total for less than a 23 million quid he gets from Real Madrid for Anelka, who's a kid with problems. So he's great at buying low, selling high. And then he sells the players as soon as they start getting old. So David Dean calls Vieira, who's 29, and says, Juventus have come in for you, and you can go if you want, meaning we're done with you. And Vieira's really offended, and he leaves. But that's what Arsenal do. They sell people like Vieira, Henri, Overmars, and so on, late 20s, boom, goodbye. And they get way more for them than they should have.
I've heard him even recently speak in like glowing terms about how he assembled the defence in that Invincibles team. He was like, basically, it was it cost £0, right? Ashley Cole, Academy, Colo Torre, he finds in the middle of nowhere. I think they paid a little bit of money for Sylvain Viltord, and Jens Lehmann cost them nothing. And even today, in the riches that football has become, Wenger really puts a lot of value about the fact that he was able to assemble these players for peanuts, essentially.
Yeah, and I think he gets, in a way, more pleasure out of a good buy and a good sell than out of winning. Mm. And I do agree that we'll come to this in the next episode, but I do agree that his weird attitude to money, his obsession with this in a way, not with getting rich, but with spending it right, is going to be part of his
downfall. He attaches a kind of moral value to his frugality, which, I mean, I'd probably argue is the German part of him.
Yeah, or maybe it's the son of a bistro owner, that you run a small business, you pinch every penny. Yeah.
He understands footballers, their nature, what makes them tick, and how the great ones operate. But then there's the other kind of numerical side where he needs to quantify what their greatness is about. And that's him sort of embracing numbers in a huge way.
Yeah, so he's really the first data-driven top manager. And so the morning after the game, he drives to the Arsenal training ground. He's very excited because the spreadsheets are going to arrive with all the data. And he spends the morning reading the spreadsheets, tracking stats. And so he starts to substitute Dennis Bergkamp after about 75 minutes. Dennis is getting a bit older. And Dennis comes into the hut and says, what's going on? Why are you taking me off? Where in your statistics does it say that I changed the game with a killer pass? Wenger says, you run less in the last 30 minutes and you're more at risk of getting injured and your pace is dropping. And so he's being not driven by data, but guided by data. And he starts to use this on transfers. So when Vieira's coming to the end, 2004, he needs to find the next Patrick Vieira. He does this very simple thing. He looks at the data to find a defensive midfielder, young, who covers the most meters per match. And it turns out it's this kid called Mathieu Flamini. He's a rookie at Olympique Marseille, and he's running 14 kilometers a match, which at the time is insane. Nobody's running 14 kilometers a match. Flamini is. Now, of course, the fact that he's running 14 kilometers, not enough. Is he running in the right direction? Can he play football? So now Wenger goes to Marseille, he sees, yep, he's running in the right direction. And so he signs Flamini, who becomes an Arsenal regular and, does very well until he leaves for free to Milan.
He doesn't get all of the players he wants. Some of them escape his grasp.
Yeah, or he screws up himself. So he's watching this big young striker, Le Mans, a small French club, guy called Didier Drogba. And Wenger's in two minds, shall I buy him, shall I not? And he lets the opportunity go. And he regrets it forever because he thinks, if we got Drogba into this Arsenal team where we can pass and then he finishes up front, he'd score a hat-trick in every game. So he beats himself over the head for a decade, I think, for missing Drogba. Cristiano Ronaldo, not his fault. Of course he knows Cristiano Ronaldo. He's a teenage kid at Sporting Lisbon.
They have a deal. There's a deal.
Yeah, yeah. They show him around the Highbury Stadium. Ronaldo gets this Arsenal shirt with a name on his back, all ready to sign. And then famously, Manchester United, they gazump the deal. United have played this friendly at Lisbon and Ronaldo's destroyed the United defence. And so United pay a bit more and they get Ronaldo. So Wenger thinks about that for the rest of his life, I think.
So Drogba ends up signs for Chelsea, eventually becomes a brilliant player. I think he scores more goals against Arsenal in the Premier League than any of the major clubs. He says that he's always motivated to score against Arsenal. And one of the things that he notices about Wenger is every time that Drogba will score a brace against Arsenal for Chelsea, in the post-match press conference, they've always asked, Drogba was the difference maker. And Wenger always poo-poos it and says, I don't think he played that well. Which again is another kind of taster of some of the bitterness that the later stage Arsene Wenger becomes. And I think it's quite a sad story, but I mean, it's great for me because Drogba trounces Arsenal every time we play them.
That's part of Wenger's personality. He never forgets and he never forgives himself. Mm. So he didn't forgive himself for not signing Drogba.
Yeah. Arsenal end up winning three league titles in that period. I guess the apotheosis of which is the Invincible season, so 2003, 2004. the year before they do that, he also says to the team, I want you to go a season unbeaten. And it kind of leaks in the media and he's ridiculed for ever even having that idea.
Yeah, how could you possibly go a season unbeaten? It's obviously not possible.
It's ridiculous to even suggest it. So they do it. I mean, what is your memory of this Invincibles team?
I saw them just before in a weirdly intimate setting. So I was up in Manchester, I was writing about Man United, and I was staying in Lowry Hotel, which is, you know, very kind of artsy boutique hotel. Mm. Manchester. And so, of course, who were there but the Arsenal team, who were playing Man City the next day. So I was with friends in the bar, and the next table was, in my memory, was a bunch of the French players, Vieira, Wiltord, Henri, and then Robert Pires comes in and he fist bumps everyone. And given Pires's look, I was irresistibly reminded of Ali G.
The goatee. He had a goatee.
He looked very Ali G, and Ali G was the figure of the time. And I'm thinking, I'm here, I'm a journalist, having a couple of beers. They were not having
so
beers.
So like, did you do the whole thing and go up to them and like...
No, we were the only tables in the bar. In one way. So we nodded in a very restrained way to each other, like, we know who you are, we're not going to bother you. Mm. And it was nearly midnight. And I thought, should you really be up? And I looked at them and it was the best footballers of the era, such perfect specimens. So grown up they looked. I mean, often when you see footballers, they look like they're children. And these guys look like adult men, and they were totally at their peak, relaxed, confident. And they're up till midnight, not because they were indisciplined, but they just thought, we've got this, we've got this. To refresh my memory, preparing for this podcast, I checked, what was the Man City Arsenal score that day? Arsenal won 5-1. I mean, obviously everyone thrashed City in those days, but still.
This was the old City, yeah.
Yeah, this was the old City, pre-Sheikh City. But still, these were guys who just, you get that with some teams that they walk onto the field and they know, we've got this. And you can imagine you're in a tunnel with Vieira, Henri, Bergkamp, Freddy Ljungberg, Jens Lehmann, that kind of rock hard English defence who could also play football. And you look at your teammates and you think, how can this possibly go wrong? And all these medals he was winning in profusion, 1996 to 2004, he just gives away. Because very like Alex Ferguson, actually, his soulmate, he just doesn't care about what you won today or yesterday. It's over. It's done. He only thinks about the future.
He tells this amazing story about one of the few times his parents come over to Highbury to see them. And I think it's in the double winning season of 98. And his father, who later passes away, you know, even at that point, winning a Premier League and an FA Cup is a huge achievement. It's his first league title. And his father said to him, I think you can do better.
His father probably huge pain for having taken a day off work to come all the way to London.
Yeah, but I mean, we've spoken a lot about the kind of foreign influence and bringing the va-va-voom of Henri. But they had an Englishish sort of spine, right? From Pat Rice to Ray Parlour and Martin Keown, and that kind of grit. And Wenger speaks about this being the perfect type of assimilation, that he brings in international influence, but the team is still kind of has a fundamental rootedness in North London and in English football. He's not trying to create, you know, tiki-taka or Barcelona football. Maybe later on he might do, and maybe that's part of the downfall. But there is something quite unique about the blend that is in that squad.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting because he's buying the best players in the world. Vieira, Henri, Bergkamp is just there before he arrives. But what he doesn't do is discard the Englishness, which would have been a temptation. And he looks at Adams, who had been a drunk, an alcoholic, and who also was a bit too English a footballer. It was a bit too simple. They were playing somewhat of a long ball game. And Wenger doesn't think, I'm going to get rid of it. He thinks, no, there's a potential here. We can make this work.
He scores goals in that season, Tony Adams. You're seeing like marauding up the pitch. And
Adams became a magnificent footballer. Yeah. And because he had this ultra-English look, you sometimes get deceived by the look.
Brexit football.
Harry Maguire has that a bit as well. So you look at
Sean Dyche kind of, yeah.
And then you think, oh, but Maguire, he can play football. He's a wonderful passer of the ball. I mean, he's actually a better passer sometimes than a defender. That was the deceptive thing about Adams and even Keown, that they could get better under Wenger, and that's also Wenger's doing.
So on that note, we have established what I think clearly were the golden years of Arsene Wenger.
And the best years ever of Arsenal.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
And to some degree, possibly the best football seen in England up to that point. It's been better since.
Pre-Pep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Obviously, you're missing over Chelsea's Mourinho, but it's fine. I'm not going to hold that against you.
And he's done it because he's brought new foreign ways into a hidebound country. He brings in how to eat proper food and not just live on alcohol and baked beans. He's brought in foreign scouting. We're going to scout the best players from all over the world. And he's brought in data. Those are absolutely key innovations. And then this culture of total professionalism throughout the organization.
So we have a manager at the peak of his powers. He's done the unthinkable, gone a domestic season without losing. And yet the Invincibles become the high watermark of Arsenal Football Club and of Wenger's managerial career. And they don't do what so many great teams have gone on to do, which is build a legacy. How does this all unravel so quickly?
Where does it all go wrong? I mean, it's astonishing how he went from the most admired, transformative manager in football to a bit of a joke within a decade. Every pioneer gets overtaken, but Wenger was spectacularly overtaken. Everybody copies the best of him. He becomes more and more like himself. He becomes stubborn and unyielding in his views. And he also starts to display this very bizarre and strong attitude to money. He has very deep beliefs about money that he thinks set Arsenal apart, but end up holding them back. So Wenger's own flaws become part of the slide of Arsenal.
Join us in the next episode.
The fall of Arsene Wenger. Thank you for listening to Heroes and Humans of Football. For more information, go to our website at heroesandhumans.com.
And follow us at Heroes and Humans on all social platforms.
Next week is part two of our two-parter on Arsene Wenger, in which we trace the fall of the man who remade English football. Be sure to give it a listen.
This show was developed by Immaterial and produced by One Fine Play. Matt Cheney is the series producer. Kazra Firuzia is the editor and producer. We have been your hosts, Mehreen Khan
and Simon Cooper.
And this has been Heroes and Humans of Football.